This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So for this month's Job Bite, we're talking to Dr. Mark Perver, who's been working at JVCA and with the Jodcast for many years now. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Welcome. I'm used to being on the other side of the microphone, but that's okay.
So you've been at Manchester for a long time now. You did your PhD here, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I have been here since 2006, one way or the other.
And with the Jodcast since it started.
Almost. You won't hear my voice in the very early episodes, but later on, yeah.
Okay, and what is it that you work on now?
Well, it's broadly what I've always been working on, which is pulsars. So they're my favourite thing in radio astronomy and something that we do a lot of at the University of Manchester.
So we've probably heard a bit about pulsars before. Could you give us a brief recap of what they are?
Yeah, well, a pulsar is something that you can find in space with a radio telescope. And it's really sort of like a special kind of star. So the ones that we typically look at are about the same distance as a star you might see in the sky. So we find them within our Milky Way galaxy. But they're a lot rarer than normal stars because they are made from the death of a star in a supernova. So when a big star gets to the end of its life, it can explode and it can leave behind a very, very dense core, which is what we call a neutron star or a pulsar. And the remarkable thing about them is that they're very, very massive and compact, and they spin very quickly, and they shoot out beams of radio waves from their magnetic poles.
Like a lighthouse.
Yeah, or at least that's our slightly simplified understanding of them. But one way or the other, we do pick up pulses from them, which again, yeah, you can imagine it being like a lighthouse. You just see the flashes. And these turn out to be quite useful little clocks in some cases, and that's really why I study them.
Is that because they're very stable? They always spin at the exact same speed and over a long period of time?
Pretty much, yeah. The rotation is very stable. They gradually slow down, but we can allow for that. And when you take that into account, their sort of predictability as a clock for some pulsars can be good enough to sort of measure an interval of about 20 years to maybe within a microsecond accuracy, something like that.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think the European Space Agency has a pulsar clock at its headquarters, is that right?
Possibly, yeah. I think it's always been one of these things that we've thought of doing. Like, on Earth now, atomic clocks keep time, and there's a whole battery of them all around the world. And in principle, you can use a battery of pulsars to do that as an alternative, and they could sort of keep a little check on each other, yeah.
So is there anything that messes up the stability of pulsars?
Yeah, there can be things. Some of them glitch, which means they'll suddenly start to spin faster. And at some level, which in our observations we're often still digging down to, we know that their rotation must show some instability, sort of like any clock. So what I concentrate on is the most accurate ones, the ones that don't really show glitches or very, very few, and the ones where the timing seems to be able to be done very, very accurately. So we call it pulsar timing when we time them. And that turns out to be a particular sort of subpopulation of pulsars that we call millisecond pulsars or recycled pulsars.
Why are these called millisecond pulsars?
Basically because they spin so quickly. So the period of time it takes them to spin once is usually between 1.2 milliseconds. That's about the fastest it's been found. And maybe going up to about 20 milliseconds, something like that. So they're spinning incredibly quickly. And they're called recycled because after formation, they, as far as we know, have been sort of accreting or robbing mass from a companion star that they're orbiting around. And that spins them up faster and faster. So they're sort of recycled from a normal pulsar into one of these millisecond pulsars. And they're nice because the magnetic field that they have, which is very, very strong for any pulsar, is somewhat weaker for a millisecond pulsar. And that seems to keep their rotation even more stable than a normal one. So we concentrate on those when we're trying to do really accurate timing.
Is another reason that they're so stable because they're going so fast? So if you think about a spinning top, it precesses as it slows down. So it gets a little bit of variance. But before, when it's going really fast, it's quite accurate.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. There's not much to slow it down. So on the outside, it's sort of surrounded by what we call its magnetosphere of particles. But of course, there's not a great deal of drag out there in space, and it seems that the emission of the radio waves is related to the magnetic field, and that is the main way they slow down. But then inside, as far as we understand, they have a superfluid interior, which means that in the middle, there's a special state of matter in which the stuff is spinning in little vortices with no friction at all. So it doesn't really have a lot of internal friction. And then on top of that, they just have a huge amount of kinetic energy as they spin. It takes a long, long time for them to slow down.
So this is very non-Newtonian stuff.
Yeah.
Really weird.
Yeah.
We don't quite know exactly what goes on in the center of a neutron star.
No, that's right. We don't.
And how come they spin up as they accrete mass?
Because as well as in sort of inheriting the mass of what they're taking, they also inherit the angular momentum or the spin of the object they're accreting from. So if the original star that they're robbing the mass from is spinning a bit, they'll inherit that. Their original sort of very rapid spin comes from the fact that they collapse down very small, and that causes them to spin more and more revolutions per second.
A bit like an ice skater.
Yeah.
As they draw their arms in. So these things are super, super dense. Could you give us an earthbound idea of what that
sounds
like?
Yeah, if it means anything, we think the typical density of a neutron star is about 1 billion tons per cubic centimetre. So a cubic centimetre is like a smallest sugar cube kind of size, and you're talking about 1 billion tons in that, which is, it's been said to be similar to the mass of all the cars on Earth.
Wow.
It's just ridiculous. But then, oddly enough, the nucleus in every atom inside us right now has a similar density. It's just that the nuclei are normally very, very spread out, and they create what we call normal matter. And in a neutron star, it seems like all that space is squeezed out.
It's condensed completely.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. Really extreme physics. So what is it that you look at with millisecond pulsars?
Well, what we've been trying to do and what I've been part of for a long time is an effort to detect gravitational waves. And that's something that's not coming from the pulsars that we're looking at, but the pulsars are clocks placed into a ripply sort of field of gravitational waves. And we hope to see those clocks changing a little bit.
So this field of gravitational waves, is that being caused by the pulsar spinning, or is it a background gravitational wave?
It's a background, yeah. So in some cases, maybe a binary pulsar system might cause gravitational waves, but that's not really what we're looking at. So we think that the gravitational waves are out there, partly because Albert Einstein predicted this in his general theory of relativity a long time ago, and partly because we think that out there in space, extreme events happen, like black holes smashing together. And this should produce these sort of ripples of gravity that we call gravitational waves. And they kind of move along, stretching and squashing the space as they go. But we also know that if they're out there, they're very, very, very tiny and weak. So they ought to be rippling around us all right now, but causing a length change as they go along of sort of, I think it's less than the diameter of a proton over the length of a meter. So
a length change in space-time, is it?
Yes, length change in space. They sort of, mostly they leave time alone, but they wobble space about. But yeah, if you imagine looking at a meter stick and trying to measure one proton, which is one subatomic particle in one atom, it's very, very tiny. But it scales up. So as we look at the pulsar signals traveling to us from a very long distance, so we can hope to see a length change that we can actually measure. And we hope to measure it as a change in when the pulses from the pulsar arrive. So the pulse travels a bit further than it had to previously, or a bit less far as the wave oscillates, and we hope to pick that up.
So you look for a change in the period of the pulsar on a very small scale.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking, if it was a very, very strong sort of individual source of gravitational waves, you'd actually see the pulses get later and then get earlier and then get later and then get earlier in a sort of a wave-like pattern.
Like a tide.
Yeah. Yeah. But because we're sort of looking for a background of lots of these things, what we actually have to do is look at the pulsars as a function of their separation on the sky. So what we care about is there some little tiny correlation? Is there something that's the same in the timing of two pulsars as a function of how far apart they are? They could be like a degree apart in the sky or 90 degrees apart in the sky. And by timing lots of pulsars, we're actually hoping to pick up the background in the vicinity of the Earth, sort of in the vicinity of the solar system, because that background will affect the timing of all the pulsars that we can see.
So you look at the background gravitational wave measure of the local solar system, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so it'd be the same ones that we're subject to now.
And you look to see if there's a similar signal change from two different pulsars coming from different directions.
Yeah, exactly. And okay. It can depend, but maybe about 20 of the best timers that we've got. So that gives you, every pair of those pulsars gives you a point on a graph, which is a function that we call a correlation function, and we hope that that graph will take on a particular shape.
So we know what we're looking for already. We're just...
Yeah, we know what we think we're looking for according to general relativity. It's possible that if there are differences between the way that gravity actually works and general relativity, that you could pick up a different shape. But yeah, we know what we think we're looking for. And the main problem is actually that these gravitational waves are so weak that this sort of graph, if we sort of drew it, rather than being a nice line that'd be really easy to see, it'd be lots of little points representing the different pairs of pulsars, and there'd be lots of noise in that graph. So that line would be subject to lots of wobbling, and we have to measure it accurately enough so that we can actually say that shape is really there and it's not just random wobbly uncorrelated points.
So does that involve looking for more and more millisecond pulsars as well? Does it get easier when you have more of them?
Yeah, it does, yeah. And they have to time to a certain accuracy as well.
So how many of them are you looking at the moment?
Well, at the moment there's about, it does vary actually, about different groups between sort of 10 and 30 at the moment. So it's not a very high number, and we're still doing surveys to find more. We know there's more out there. We might find one that times better, and even one that was really good would significantly add to what we have.
So you have a whole list of millisecond pulsars, and then you have to chuck them off the list when they don't meet your criteria.
Yeah, some
there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah, and there's that we can find. The number of millisecond pulsars last time I checked is around about 200 or so. So it's pretty small. And then the trouble with some of them is if they're quite far away and the signal is quite weak, that affects our timing. So our limit on accuracy is not really the rotational stability. It's more how well can we pick up those pulses? How well can we pick up those ticks?
So how good our equipment is, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we think there's the potential to get better and to make a real detection. And so far, all anyone's been able to do is say, well, here's an upper limit on how strong that gravitational wave background can be. We know it can't be any stronger than that because we would have found it otherwise. And we hope to push the detection threshold, the detection limit down and down until eventually the real thing comes out and we can say we've found gravitational waves.
So does that involve possibly waiting for a new telescope to be built, or... How do you what telescopes do you detect them with at the moment, and could we make that detection with those?
Yeah, that's a good question. So certainly when the Square Kilometre Array comes along, and that telescope's supposed to solve everybody's problems, and that'll be amazing, but that's still quite a few years away. But we can try and improve on what we've got by joining telescopes together. So radio telescopes like the Lovell Telescope at Jodrell Bank, there's one at Effelsberg in Germany. There's a few of them out there. There's Green Bank and Arecibo in the United States, Parkes in Australia. And by combining the timing data from all of those, that makes you more sensitive. So that has been going on for some time in what they call pulsar timing arrays. And the one in Europe is called the EPTA, or European Pulsar Timing Array, and they bring their timing data all together. But it's sort of become clear as it's been done that there are a few difficulties. It's hard to hammer down that accuracy, because what you really want is each pulsar to be timed very accurately, maybe to an accuracy of sort of 100 nanoseconds. You find that your telescopes have different back-end instruments that are processing the data, and that can make life difficult. And so we have got to the point with the EPTA where we can soon to publish a new limit on the strength of gravitational waves, and that's great, but we also know that we haven't got to the point where we can detect them yet.
But hopefully in the next 10 years.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, they keep...
Is there a prediction? Or is it always 10 years away?
It's always 5 years away, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. When I started my PhD, it was 5 years away. That's an optimistic estimate. But, I mean, the thing is, the limits are going down.
Mm. Yeah. Whenever you make a detection, there's always... you always improve the limits, and you can always close in on the result, even when you haven't.
Exactly.
Quite got it yet.
Yeah.
So EPTA or EPTA have recently been working on a series of papers, which you are named on.
Yeah.
I think there are six of them named papers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
Imaginatively. And they've done a little bit of a Star Wars thing. 4, 5, and 6 come out before the first three. So.
Yes. They've all been written in concurrently. And yeah, they may be coming out like Star Wars, but hopefully they won't sort of peak at number 5 or 6, depending which your favourite Star Wars are.
Hopefully they'll all be of good quality. Yeah. So what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis working with this big collaboration? Because with all these telescopes and that sort of stuff, I guess there's lots of people doing lots of different things.
Yeah, what I've been working on is within a sort of subgroup of the EPTA that's called LEAP. And LEAP's an exciting project which stands for the Large European Array for Pulsars, a good old contrived acronym. But that is really trying to take another step forward to improve the accuracy that we're doing the timing with. And it's by taking hold of 5 radio telescopes that we have in Europe. And instead of combining the timing data sort of after the fact, which is the usual way of doing it, we're trying to use the telescopes, what they call coherently, which means you're actually making the observations exactly the same time with all those telescopes. And you're joining the signals, or you're adding the signals together so that they are as good as one telescope. And it turns out that actually gives you a bigger improvement in your timing accuracy, as long as you can do it right. So once again, trying to beat down the accuracy and the sort of limits that we can place, we are trying this trick of lashing the telescopes together coherently rather than what they normally call incoherent addition, which is the usual way of doing it. So the difficulty with LEAP is that you have to add these signals together with a certain delay, and that delay has to be worked out very, very accurately. And it has to be able to change slightly over time, because as the signals come to the different telescopes, they're coming from the same place, but they take a different time to reach each one slightly, because they're in different places on the Earth. But then, as they go through the atmosphere, the ionosphere, part of our atmosphere, although it's only very, very slight, it does change how long the signals take to travel to us, you know, by nanoseconds to microseconds at most. Because our telescopes are widely spaced out, we have to assume that the weather is different in the different places. And that means that you constantly have to make little corrections.
It's definitely
the ionosphere.
Because one's in the UK and one's in Spain or something, or Italy, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so even though coherent addition of telescopes is done with other sources, it's particularly hard with pulsars.
Is that because it's such a brief moment in time?
Yeah, and they're weak. Compared to other sources. So when you look for a single pulse, normally you don't even see it because there's a bit of noise. There's always some random noise in your observations and it's hidden within it.
Do you actually have to stack pulses on top of each other?
Exactly. That so that's called folding, and you stack them up and then you see the average pulse. But doing that sort of just to get what they call the coherent fringes, which means a certain pattern that shows that you're actually, you've got the delays correct and you're adding everything up right, to get those fringes with a folded signal is an extra step of complexity compared to what normally happens with this coherent addition. So that's why we've had to work on making software.
I guess, on when the actual timing happens. So you have to force them to be on top of each other.
Exactly.
In case you can't see what you're looking for, which is a difference in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so our approach has been, rather than doing it online, which means a big computer mashes through the data all in real time, we've been storing all the data from all the telescopes on these sort of high density tapes, and combining it afterwards, which means that we can keep adjusting the delays, looking for the fringes, going back, changing things, which is offline sort of processing. There's loads and loads of data that these telescopes spit out that all have to get stored on tapes and have to be brought together. So that's the other big challenge.
It's high volume stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I was working this out. We observe over a bandwidth of 128 megahertz, which is quite big, to try and catch as much of the radio band as we can. And that means that each telescope generates around about 500 megabytes of data per second. So if you have a really good new hard disk, and that's probably about 2 terabytes of storage, you could store about an hour of data from one telescope on that hard disk, and then your hard disk would be full up.
And how long have we been doing this timing for?
We've been doing it for a few years now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly how much it's been stored in total. It's no longer terabytes, it's now petabytes.
Okay.
Where a petabyte is 1 million gigabytes. So there's loads on all these tapes, and we move the tapes around to bring them together and correlate the data.
So they're kept very safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you sort of have to accept that occasionally an observation or two will go wrong, but the sort of the bulk of the tapes are all kept safe. We load them onto computers, we process everything.
I guess when you've got that much data, does it even make it hard to back up?
Like, yes, it's pretty hard. So the tapes are really our sort of backup storage. And then when we're processing it, we load it onto other machines to do it, because a tape is really nice for storing a lot of data, but it's not nice for looking through rapidly. You just want to sort of reel it out like an audio cassette and get all the data off onto something else. But that's all stuff that's been ongoing, and there's a team of people who've been doing that. It's working, and we're getting really accurate timing results. We have to keep averaging for quite a long time. So we sort of do monthly observations of all the telescopes together for maybe 24 hours at a time. And then we will add those sort of simultaneous correlated observations to the timing data that we already have. And that will hopefully then enable an even lower limit on gravitational waves. And if we're really lucky and we keep doing it well, maybe we'll get a direct detection and pip the SKA before it's even finished to a first detection.
Which won't render it useless, but it will be a good place to start looking.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it would be really nice for the SKA to know what level the background's at before they even start. That would be excellent. The SKA will get greater sensitivity on it and hopefully start to explore it in more detail, and that will help to tell us about things going on in the universe, black hole mergers and those sort of things from gravitational waves as we get from radio waves and other sorts of waves now.
It's excellent stuff. But as always with radio and with pulsars, there's a lot of interference, and yeah, that's where you come in.
Yeah. What I've been working on mostly in recent times is the slightly more mundane end of it, because you're absolutely right. These signals come along and they then get mishmashed with interference made by radio devices on the Earth.
So we don't help ourselves, do we?
No. It could be mobile phones, microwave ovens,
yeah,
airport radar, all these kinds of things.
All the stories we've been hearing, yeah. Hungry astronomers.
Exactly. And all our telescopes are in places where they're subject to that interference. And so my job has been developing a method, which some other people have made originally for solar observations, and making that automatically filter out as much of the interference as possible from our telescope so we can get to the real data. And we have to kind of do that automatically, because although you can look through and make graphs, no one's got time to look through all that data. Sometimes this interference is popping up every few milliseconds and you can cut it out, but it has to be done automatically. So what I've been working on is this statistical method, which kind of takes a chunk of data. Essentially, it's a bit like making a histogram, if anyone can remember that. When you make histograms, usually at school you used to make histograms of how tall people were.
Oh, yeah.
So in the class, you'd band everyone up. You'd say, right, these number of people are between 1 and 110 metres, 110, 120, 120, 130. Yeah, so the histogram shows how many there are in each group, and hopefully it makes a nice bell-shaped curve. And really we're looking at the same thing with our radio data. So nice radio data, which is the sort of random background noise that's fine, that's okay, makes these sort of statistics. It makes what we call a Gaussian distribution, this kind of bell curve. But if you take a bunch of data points and you make a histogram out of it and it looks like something completely different, then you may well suspect that you've got some interference on your hands and you cut it out. And that's essentially how the method works. And it seems to do pretty well. I mean, no method is perfect, but it's helped to clean up a lot of data that would otherwise have been kind of spoiled. And the nice thing is it can work on really small chunks of time and really small chunks of frequency. So we can cut out, it's like using a little scalpel rather than a hammer, you know, to cut the cut out the interference,
yeah,
leaving us with what we want.
It's a really important job as well, because the interference just gets worse as we get more technical and as we look at smaller and smaller things.
Yeah, something that can be applied not just to pulsars as well. So it can help us out with different observations.
Oh, fantastic. So thanks very much for giving us this job bite.
No problem.
And we'll hope to speak to you again soon.
Yep, I hope so. All right.
Cheers, Mark.
Thank you.